Punctual as always, Ezekiel J. Kralin from San Francisco, and I'm turning you up and seeing if it begins to feed back, and it isn't feeding back. Ezekiel, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, seems to be working fine. And you've written a story, and I have the text in front of me here, but I don't know where to break it in order to break it in two. Would you do that job for me and read as much as you need to read and then stop?
Yeah, I already know exactly where I'm going to stop for the first half.
Okay, are you calling from your house, from your place of...
From my hovel, yes.
Your hovel, your apartment. I imagine that it's like the inside of apartments in places like Hell's Kitchen in the comic book TV shows that I enjoy so much.
It has some of that, yes.
And your internet connection is still the...
it's very good tonight. I've been listening all along. I'm highly urinated.
Urinated, isn't that interesting? What word do you think that was intended to be there?
I don't know. I'm thinking it's a typo.
Yeah, you're highly urinated. Well, he did say later that before you go into that movie is very long, so go to the bathroom first. Maybe that's what he was thinking. Okay,
well,
go
ahead. It's possible. Larkin may give a whack on the sign outside, which is a signal. He does it about twice a week or so. If that happens, I'll just run to the window with the phone and say, hey, you want to talk to the radio host or something. I don't think it's going to happen, but there's no way I'm going to ignore him if he signals to me.
Oh, I was thinking that person was a fictional character. You're talking about the Larkin in your stories?
Yes. It's real.
Wow. That is? That's wonderful. You know, Juanita... there's a man named Paul Katziff who runs the Thanksgiving Coffee here in Fort Bragg and underwrote my show for quite a while, and I'm looking forward to talking with him sometime soon about that. But he once told me that he didn't think that my wife was real because he only heard about her on the radio, and he looked right at my hand while he was saying that because we were in the lobby at the theater, and I don't have a wedding ring on. See, and so I told him that she's real, and maybe we could bring her in and have her meet him at some point. But he thought that she was like Gracie. She was like an imaginary character. Gracie was real, but an imaginary character that a comedian might use.
Yes, well, Larkin is a superb trickster, and he's been playing that with me for years, avoiding meeting anyone I know. And some people think I'm making it up. I say, he's this wonderful guy. That's amazing. He's so funny. Well, I figured out his games. That's what he... doing. He puts me in these terribly awkward situations. So, are we ready for the story?
I am, yeah. Go ahead, anytime you want.
Okay. Hug of the Century. Exculpatory reader. Finally, Larkin asked me for a hug. The first time he's ever done that, actually. Previously, he'd just come up and hug me. Or say, give me a hug, Zeke. Or I would ask him. But as you know, the hugs became rare. Once he resurfaced in the Castro. And I always had to ask, sometimes beg him even. The last time we hugged was more than 2 years ago, until last night. The point is this, he never asked before. It was an extraordinary encounter, around 1:15 a.m. But let me describe the events earlier that evening, Sunday, June 11th, which led up to it. Really hurting to see him again, even a glimpse, these past few days. In fact, I was speaking to him in my mind with words like, listen, buddy, I'm begging you. So much time has passed, and I still reach out to you. My life ain't so great, and my soul is utterly crushed at this point. Can't you please, please, please stop this game and start being the awesome friend I know you truly are? I think that a lot of my grief comes not from this Trump era, my bad teeth, or any other trial, that it actually is the lovesickness I've carried in my heart for him these many, many years. So I heard my Wiley Wyvern's booming voice from across the street around 9:30 p.m., looked out the window, and saw his huge, incredible self joking around with some ladies on their way to whatever Castro venue. He showed off by a powerful karate kick on the traffic sign opposite the one by my edifice. I sought to holler out, I heard that, Larkin, or something, but decided to keep quiet and just watch. He did some funny dance, twirled around, and the girls guffawed. Then he waved him goodbye and continued towards Castor Street, his lanky arms waving in the air as he marched on into the Stygian Vale. I then looked at my unprepared meal and decided to eat later on, for I was itching to glimpse him once more. I put my sneakers on, a warm jacket, and a black knitted cap with a ring of large snowflakes atop, which I found left behind on a metro seat 3 weeks back. Old Chinese ladies seem to love these hats. And meandered down Market to Castro, then left on 18th. He suddenly popped out of the mix, same direction as yours truly, who was now barely 20 feet behind, his strapping presence. I don't think he saw me. I almost called out, but chose to remain incognito, as I watched him cut diagonally across 18th Street and onwards to Moby Dick, which is almost catty-corner from the mix. Some folks seemed to be arguing further down the sidewalk on my side of 18th, and Larkin heard them, so he paused before entering the other bar and hollered to them, "Don't be mad, be glad." "Humph," I thought, "what a hypocrite." So I then bolted my voice in his direction. "You should follow your own advice." He seemed to not hear, though I'm sure he did. So I repeated my declaration before he disappeared through the doorway. I walked by Moby Dick several times, but his back was facing the street, so I don't really know if he saw me, though I suspect he did. I finally returned Hovel. I prepared my simple supper of packaged brown and red rice with herbs and veggies that only takes 90 seconds in the microwave. After my first few bites, I started itching once more to get out there and see if maybe I could get another glimpse of my inamorato, as Marco so aptly calls him. To my disappointment, he was no longer hanging at Moby Dick, nor the mix, nor a bow. So I stepped back inside for some minutes, but grew restless again and decided to have a smoke or two for my small collection of today's snipes outside by the bus shelter. "Is that Larkin?" I thought, reacting to a boisterous holler further down the street, probably outside Bow. I squinted to see if I could find his silhouette among the crowd of shadows gathered there out front. After a minute or so, I made him out and saw his form begin to saunter in my direction. He didn't spot me as I made sure to hide behind the inner wall of the shelter. Once he kicked the signpost, I called out my usual, "I heard that." He paused then and peered up at my window, which now has that lovely scent-diffusing lamp placed on the ledge and glowing its spectrum of juicy colors slowly and one by one. At the moment, it shone a radiant lavender. He tilted his head, waiting for me to poke my face out the window, I guess, then said, "Where are you?" "Ha," I chuckled to myself, "he thinks I'm upstairs." So I called him once more. "I'm right here, Larkin." Yet he still gazed up, thinking my voice came from above. So I clarified to his booze-addled sensibilities, "I'm right here, dog, by the bus stop." He looked his beautiful self upon approaching. I noticed some thin streaks of silver in those thick, close-cut waves of dark auburn. He came up really close, his face barely 3 inches from mine, and declared, "You need to get out of my life." I just looked into those glorious, aureate eyes and that blondie-kissed mug, which never fails to astound me. Then he spit a big wad of saliva right on my left cheek and nose. I stood my ground in utter calm and remarked, "Good to see you again, Larkin." "Ugh!" He raised his arms in exasperation and moved a few feet away from me. I cannot really capture in words the brilliant scenario he obviously prepared in advance. He is such an excellent trickster. So I'll just attempt to list his various antics, which took up a generous 15 or 20 minutes in total, the longest time we've spent together in almost 3 difficult years. Fidgeting with his cell phone as he leaned against the bus shelter, he cursed and confided that he's a mess and needs help. I watched as he kept pressing different parts of the cell phone screen, which displayed a handsome naked blonde fellow in the background. He seemed to have trouble finding a number or app, as he kept tapping away in frustration. "I hate cell phones," I interjected. Then he muttered how he hates computers and something about failing a computer test. Seeing as I'm a PC hobbyist, well-versed in this field of technology, I offered to help him at no cost. "Fuck that," he spoke with scorn. "I don't want your help," he grumbled further. "Life sucks, and then you die." "But I'm here for you, Larkin. You don't need to feel so bad." Then he started ranting once more how I needed to extricate myself from his world, put his face quite close to mine again, and spat on me again. I was not fazed in the least, as I know his mischief and had no reason to respond with anger. In fact, I greatly appreciated the scripted scenario of an outrageously handsome, superbly talented dude so cray-cray in love with me, he stupefied. Very cute. He raised his arms to the sky, then turned away and began to walk off as I stood there in silence, allowing the saliva to drip down my cheek, some of which touched my lips. It was a gorgeous night, by the way. Cool ocean breezes kissed the balmy air and a bold, almost full moon, a wan yellow. I decided to praise him. "You're a good man, Larkin." Upon those words, he looked down at his feet and muttered, "Oh, I know I'm a good man. It's you I wonder about." "Geez, he's really rubbing the shit in my face tonight," I mused with a repressed chuckle. "In fact," he looked directly into my eyes from 10 feet away, "you're a royal fuck-up, a big, fat, royal son-of-a-bitch fuck-up." I said nothing because I knew this is a game, and I love him very much, so just enjoy the ride. He then stepped up and double-finger tapped me firmly on the chest. "Oh, you are such a fuck-up. I'm sorry you've ever been in my life, even for a minute." So he wants to play angry daddy to my bad boy. I thought, okay, I'll go along with it. It's kind of fun. "You know, Zeke," he confided, bent down with our noses almost touching. His ember smoky eyes zoomed into mine. "I really thought you were the one for me. Really. For quite a while. I truly believe you were my Mr. Right. My best buddy of all time, my soulmate." He suddenly withdrew, still erect with that crestfallen visage looming down on me like a thundercloud. "But you had to go and fuck everything up, didn't you?" "All right," I mused, "I'm a bad boy. It's all my fault, and nothing will ever make up for that. I was so close to having him. Now I must roast in Gehenna for the rest of my sorry life. Ha ha." But I was touched by him even admitting he felt that way for me. I relished the heck out of his sweet, silly reprimands that were his unique way of professing great admiration towards this trembling pilgrim of love's long journey. Larkin twisted his lips in scorn. "You ruined my life!" He spoke those accusatory words with arms extended and hands cupped like a medieval mendicant. His forehead squiggled like a whimpering Shar-Pei. "No, I didn't," I replied matter-of-factly. "Yes, you did." Then came a pregnant pause, as if he were expecting yours truly to pick up the next line in a script. I felt like I was playing into some kind of riddle, like a knock-knock joke. So I exhaled, then spoke the following words right on cue. "Okay, I'll bite. How did I ruin your life, Larkin?" His reply was prompt, no doubt because he wrote the damn script in the first place. "You got me kicked out of Twin Peaks." I pondered a few moments as he stood there, frozen in that tableau of utter destitution. Then I shrugged my shoulders and held out my hands in equal hopelessness to echo, "I'm sorry." He then vigorously waved his Samsung in my direction. "Don't say you're sorry." I guess the point there was, concupiscent reader, had I not stood up to him and defended myself with pepper spray to stop his shoving me, he would not respect me. I believe he intended me to do just that by setting up the scenario in the first place, waiting to see how much pushing me around it would take before I got fed up. Just to FYI. Larkin stepped up his whining over all the friends he made there, and what a piece of shit I am. While I just stood there, lips sealed, picturing his cornucopia of newfound friends. mostly elderly, some ready to topple over with their final breath. There's a reason locals call that place the Glass Coffin. Whose fat wallets inspired him to cozy up and charm them to pieces with all his witty tales and words of affection. Accompanied, of course, with equally affectionate touches, they gratefully return his ministrations by showering him with free drinks, 10 and 20 spots, and God only knows whatever additional services he offered, such as escort, companion, errand boy, housekeeper, and so forth. I doubt, however, he provided any sexual favors, but so handsome and talented a hustler he is, I do not begrudge one smidgen his adept ability to thrive financially in this difficult world. I only am laughing at his keen wit and robust presentation through whatever challenges that would make most independent rogues eventually wither away in despair by the time they hit middle age. And Larkin is now 54. So please, embryonic reader, be clear about one thing at the very least. My laughter is born of joyful admiration. He finally paused to relieve his lungs, thus providing me with the rare opportunity to interject a retort in my defense. Well, you ruined my life, too. Then he came up close once more with a lowered head and a hand upon my shoulder. Look, Zeke, you can spit on me as much as you want. I don't care. Go ahead, hock a loogie on me. He's my lovebird, though, so why would I spit back, I thought. And I know he heard, even though I kept my mouth shut. As he pulled away, he emphasized once more, but you really need to get out of my life. I then released these words bottled up inside my yearning corazón. Some years back, you said the nicest thing to me, nicer than anyone else has ever said or ever will. Of course, I meant that day back in May of 2014 when he lowered his frame, placed his hands on both my shoulders, looked right into my eyes, and confided, our friendship, our being brought together is an incredible godsend. I wanted to further state that I'm answering to that and have been ever since he made such a divine revelation. But of course he interrupted with pomp and circumcision, drowning any further words of mine in the process. But I refuse to get frustrated at this as I realize he's been testing me, so to speak, testing my fidelity and will over a span of 10+ years. Maybe not a test so much as a kind of shamanic initiation. He then came up to me again, glaring down at my black ski cap encircled with a halo of large white snowflakes. Are you stupid? I said nothing. Are you stupid? I still kept mum. Are you stupid? No, I finally ejaculated. Then he demanded I lean against the shelter's back wall beside him where he resumed tapping at the cell phone. So I did. He insisted I place my back against that wall and put my hands in my pockets as he moved to lean against the plate glass window of the super-duper hot dog bistro and light a cigarette. He fumbled in his pockets but could not find them. Fuck, where's my cancer? I can't find my cancer now. With that, he came forward and started to punch my chest with his fist. Not too hard, mind you, but I flinched each time, a natural reflex. Come on, you can take it, he tried to shame me. Nah. Run back to your little cave now like a pussy. I ignored him by staying put, whereby he delivered a few more semi-tough punches and reiterated that I'm free to run back into the building like a wuss. I did no such thing, of course. I was drooling over all this attention. Throughout these little dramas, folks walked by, pausing a bit to discern whether or not they should intervene on my behalf, including a Mexican worker who was toting a wheelie garbage bin to the curb. But they moved on, seeing this was more play than danger. Larkin then ordered me to stay put for 5 minutes against the shelter's wall and not speak a word. Can you do that? Can you just shut up for 5 minutes? I bet you can't. Keeping my lips sealed, I nodded. Really, can you do that? Just keep quiet for 5 fucking minutes? I knew he was trying to get me to speak, but I remained steadfast and silent. He then discovered a cigarette pack of which 2 tobacco sticks remained. But he had trouble getting one lit. I held out my own lighter, but he rejected the offer. Several minutes passed, with my standing in one spot and him mumbling all sorts of silly things, trying to look as outraged as a fire hose drenched cat. Before he lit the cancer, he came right up to me with the cigarette dangling from those yummy lips. Then, with his mug real close to mine, he started gurning them, which displaced the ciggy, moving it around at ridiculous angles and positions, sometimes even between the nose and upper lip. The cigarette appeared to move about with a life of its own, sometimes twirling in one direction, then the next, crossing his eyes and rolling them awkwardly, only served to enhance the absurd spectacle. I swear, avuncular reader, I do not see how he did that without assistance from at least a finger or two. The ciggy, I mean, not the eyes, hearty har-har. Truly hilarious. It was all I could do to keep from busting out in guffaws and collapsing helpless onto the concrete. But I somehow managed to keep a poker face through it all. To be continued.
Got it. Okay, so that's...
I had fun reading it.
That's where I'm picking it up, poker face through it all. I'm putting a line on that. I'm going to keep that separate from the other things. And I'll read the second half of it next week.
Sure.
All right. Was that useful for you to read that out loud?
I loved it. I've been so frustrated not being able to read my writings and stuff. I mean, all these places, these coffee houses where they do open mic, you only have 5 minutes. Now it's down to 3 minutes, and then you don't know how long you got to wait, and then you got to wait. It's just too frustrating.
Why do they have it such a short time? Is there that many people?
Because there's other people, and they got to fit them all in.
Wow, that must be an interesting thing to go and sit in front of and hear like 20 or 30 people over the course of a night.
Well, I used to do some of that, and I did some stand-up comedy, and people just loved it. But I thought this was a way of getting known, but it turned out there are already cliques in there, and if you're not part of them, they're going to push you out. I mean, it's not like you just go there and hopefully get known. You have all these other things going on, scary things, and even if they're not as talented as you, and I'm very good at stand-ups, they'll get you out because they're trying to make a buck too. So, you know, I've had a lot of homophobia too, not from the audience, but from other people who were going to do some readings, or even management. Hmm.
So you've done stand-up comedy then?
Oh, yeah. That's my stage name for that is Jehovah's Queer Witness.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Are you in any way in the state of mind that you'd need to be in to do a kind of a impromptu, extemporaneous stand-up bit like now?
Well, I don't know.
Or is you need an audience?
I'm mostly a humorist or the stand-up. I don't memorize stuff. I like to read off paper.
Uh-huh, I see. Like Mark Twain. Mark Twain.
Yeah. I got lots of funny stuff. I can read you something real short right now. It's called My Best Friend Yote, but I have to just get to the page on my website, okay?
Sure, I'll wait.
I mean, it's on my hard drive, is what I mean, too. It's very short and very funny. Let's see now. Get to my web page, then get to my right section, and then I'm going to load the index page, and then I'll get down to the story.
Your voice sounds... I don't remember where you're from. You're from... Did you tell me once that you're from New Jersey?
Brooklyn, close.
Uh-huh, yeah, because there's a friend of mine from a long while back, his name was Verge Belanger, who had a show on a radio station around here. He was from back east that I think of as the old country, but the people there all think of the old country as being even farther east than that. He had a radio show, and his voice was a lot like yours.
Huh.
He had a show on KZN.
I'm glad I still have some of my accent. I like Brooklyn accents. Right, so... This is a sort of a comic skit. It's called My Best Friend Yote. All right. Let's see here. Coyote the Trickster is such a talented joke writer that he even publishes big books of his silly meanderings. A few years ago, he presented me his then-latest collection, 1001 Skull-Fucking Jokes by Coyote T. Trickster. Each was a gut-busting hee-haw from the very first morsel to the very last. And if you read them in order, the next joke is always a teensy bit funnier than the previous. Read them out of order, and it doesn't work that way. Some are funnier, some not as funny. While the largest portion are equally funny. Why, I really don't know. That's Coyote's special magic, to which even I, his very best friend, am not privy. But I digress. Several new moons after showing me that book, Coyote returned with a new collection, this one entitled 1001 Skull Fucking Jokes, Volume 2, by Coyote T. Trickster. And I exclaimed, Kai, you need to get off this skull fucking stick. Come on, you're a very smart Coyote. Surely you can come up with an entirely new scene. Coyote stared at me blankly, indicating I would need to cease the soft-heartedness of my friend and display some good old-fashioned shit-kicking sarcasm. So I added, after a little deliberation, may these happy hunting grounds wither and turn to squirrel dung and get blown away into the four corners of the world before I ever lay eyes on a book entitled 1001 Skull-Fucking Jokes, Volume 3, by Coyote T. Trickster. Do you get my drift, dear brother? I certainly do, little pony. That's my Lakota name, said Coyote, raising a paw in thought to his forehead. I'll come up with a whole new theme and show you the first joke I write. Let me go now and compose the very first part of my next opus. I'll be seeing you again real soon, little bro. Looking forward to your next joke, Yote. I waved au revoir as he scampered down our village path to his own little teepee, 7 stations down the A-line, and 4 down the D, or take the C-2 if you're not in a hurry and would enjoy a rustic view out your window. Well, the new moon came and went without Coyote showing up. Indeed, it wasn't before 5 new moons had come and gone that he finally returned, so excited he could barely speak. When you finally catch your breath, silly brother, I commented, trying to hide my curiosity as best as possible. Tell me why it took you so long to compose one lousy joke. Little pony, here it is, the first joke, and so much more. Coyote hopped about my kitchen, knocking over teapot, peace pipe, and stash. In fact, I did write joke numero uno within scarce minutes of our last parting, but I got so excited with that one, I just had to write a dozen more. You know, like a baker's dozen? As by now, I really wanted to please you. Well, a dozen led to another dozen, and then to a dozen, and voila, my latest book, brother. You'll be so happy, proud of me. Check this out. And so I was handed a tome so heavy, it almost dropped from my hands when I received it from Kai's trembling paws. I set it on my lap and looked down at the book and its title, 1001 Brain Fucking Jokes by Coyote T. Trickster. And that's the end.
Like a Yiddish theater humor, sort of.
Well, yeah. I told him to write any more scuffling jokes, so he wrote one called Your Brain Fucking Jokes. But yes, it is it's one of my Native American type tales.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
All right, well, it's 1:30, and we've been talking on the phone for half an hour or so. You read half of your story, which was, the title was, again,
Hug of the Century.
Maybe we can do this again sometime. Thank you so much for sending me your stories. I look forward to it, and I just had a little problem figuring out where to break this particular story.
It could have been broken anywhere. I don't care, but I was honored to be able to read again, and it's been a great pleasure. I've been listening, and I'm going to continue listening after we hang up.
Okay, but I just want to ask a question.
Yeah.
Did you make any progress on getting your teeth fixed?
No, it's no good because they don't do partial plates, and so, you know.
So there's nobody working on getting some resolution there. This is just a thing.
There can't be a resolution. They'll pull out what teeth that can't be saved, and they'll save the rest, which is 3 or 4. So, but they won't do partial plates. I'll be stuck with 3 or 4 teeth sticking out, which is a worse situation than I have now. At least now I have still some chewing power. No, I'm totally disgusted with that. Totally disgusted. But I just use it as a way to rise above it, and you know, the amazing thing is Larkin also has bad teeth. His teeth started going a few months after mine. I had no idea.
He's younger than you are, though. He's like what, 12 years younger than you are?
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is, he is so successful with meeting people and so on. I mean, he's so beautiful, and he's tall, 6'4". And yet, his teeth look horrible, but people don't notice it yet. I find it very interesting that he's still so accepting and well-loved, and there's many people who have money. And why haven't they taken care of his teeth? It's like they're owning him or controlling him. He would make such a great party mixer for gay events and celebrations. He's just astounding. But it's sort of like they're keeping him down. He knows many wealthy people, many connections. So I'm on another level, and that's part of what my book is about. I'm fighting for his survival and trying, you know, and these people hate me. And so that's why we can't really be together, because, you know, they tell him who we can have friends with, who we can't and stuff. But he moved a block away from me, and now is hanging out. One of the bars he hangs out is the closest one to me in the Castro. He only goes to bars with pool tables. This one doesn't have a pool table. And he's trying to get a job at one of the two little restaurants below me. So there's all that underground intrigue going on, too.
Well, it sounds like you've got it under control. I mean, you understand what's going on, and you're moving forward anyway.
Oh, yeah, I've learned to look at life at two levels. You know, everyone loves a good horror story, right? But no one really wants to have a real monster attacking them. So the real monster that is attacking me and Larkin, when I step out of it, I say, wow, this is a great story, right? This is incredible. And that has given me the ability to be like above and around it all and help shape it and realize these are actors and actresses setting this up so I can be a hero. They are not ultimately enemies. They are helping make me a hero. And as I've come to understand this over the years, I've had affirmation that is exactly the way to see it, and I've gotten excellent results.
No, that's very wise. That's the superhero story in a nutshell.
Yes, and Larkin is my spiritual guardian. He has taught me many, many things. Yeah, amazing man.
All right, I'm glad that I got to talk with you, and we'll do this again sometime. Next time I'll be in Fort Bragg doing the show. Is in a couple of weeks. Maybe you'll call again then.
Okay, sounds great. All right, thank you very much again.
Bye-bye, Ezekiel J. Kralin.